Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes today, Elizabeth Warren, the Harvard professor charged with oversight of the federal bank bailout. But first, the angry buzz over one of the banks that benefited from the bailout. Goldman Sachs just yesterday posted the biggest quarterly profit in its 140-year history, an astonishing $3.5 billion profit just months after receiving bailout money. How did they do it? Well, reporter Matt Taibbi thinks he knows. He says it started with former Goldman colleagues in Washington orchestrating the bailout in Goldman's favor, accounting techniques in which Goldman hid losses and posted bailout money as profit, reeling in new investors, a practice of moving earnings offshore, making hardly paying any taxes, and finally, going back to business as usual. Taibbi's story in Rolling Stone magazine is headlined "The Great American Bubble Machine." We'll link you to it at our website. In it, Taibbi says Goldman Sachs engineered every major market manipulation since the Great Depression and is poised to do it again if the climate change legislation with its cap-and-trade provision becomes law. We'll get his thoughts on that. But Matt Taibbi, who joins us, how do you really feel about Goldman Sachs?
Yeah, well, the news yesterday was pretty amazing, that's for sure.
Well, were you surprised?
I think a lot of people were surprised at the ginormity of the number. I mean, everybody knew that they were going to come out with a high profit number, but nobody expected it to be quite that big. And given everything that went on with all the government assistance in the last year, the number that they put out yesterday is obscene.
Is it connected to the government assistance?
Absolutely.
Well, you think so. Let's walk through your thinking. You start with ex-Goldman CEO Henry Paulson, who was Secretary of the Treasury under Bush, an architect of the bailout. He makes the decision not to bail out Lehman Brothers. Impact
right
on Goldman Sachs?
Oh, absolutely. It removed their largest competitor from the marketplace. And in that same week, you know, Goldman probably would have gone out of business if AIG had been allowed to proceed to an ordinary bankruptcy without government intervention.
Well, hold on. You've moved on to AIG. This is the huge insurance company. The day after not bailing out Lehman Brothers, Henry Paulson does bail out AIG. What's the impact on Goldman Sachs?
Goldman was AIG's single largest creditor. AIG owed Goldman about $20 billion. So if AIG had gone under, Goldman would have gone under.
Instead, AIG immediately pays back Goldman Sachs. And how do they pay them back?
With taxpayer money. So Paulson, who again is the former head of Goldman Sachs, he greenlights this $80 billion taxpayer-funded bailout of AIG, and about $13 billion of those dollars went directly to Goldman Sachs. Subsequently, this is the funny part, he installed another former Goldman banker named Ed Liddy as head of AIG, and Goldman goes on to get paid 100 cents in the dollar for everything that AIG owed it, whereas they would have been left high and dry if AIG hadn't been bailed out.
Well, the next step, Henry Paulson announces TARP. This is the Troubled Asset Relief Program. Let's remind ourselves about these troubled assets. Investment banks like Goldman created vehicles to package, as you call them, lousy mortgages, troubled assets, and then sell them. And then Goldman arranged with AIG to insure those troubled assets with those so-called credit default swaps. You explained that in 2000, the New York Insurance Department, which was run by a former Goldman vice president, decides not to regulate those swaps as insurance. So as you write, Goldman and AIG are off to the races, buying and trading both bundled mortgages and then insuring them with these credit default swaps. What's the effect of that?
A lot of this goes back to ancient history, but back when Bob Rubin, who again was another former head of Goldman Sachs, was Bill Clinton's Treasury Secretary, there was a tremendous movement with Rubin, with Lawrence Summers, and with Alan Greenspan to make sure that the derivatives market was unregulated. And they went ahead, and in the last days of Clinton's presidency, they passed a very little-known law called the Commodity Futures Modernization Act, which made sure that these derivatives were unregulated. And that led more or less directly to a couple of things. It led to this massive boom in the credit default swap market, which led to the AIG mess, but it also enabled banks like Goldman Sachs to create this sort of a problem with bad mortgages because it allowed them to create a secondary market for bad mortgages.
Well, you write that at the peak of the housing boom, I think this is 2006 at this point, Goldman was underwriting almost $77 billion worth of these mortgage-backed securities, and a third of those were these lousy subprime mortgages.
They were writing an enormous amount of these bad mortgages.
So they get some of the TARP money, again, the Troubled Asset Relief Program. It's supposed to relieve investors because they have these troubled assets on their books. But let's be clear. Goldman says at this point they didn't want the TARP money, the bailout money, because it came with strings attached. They say they were one of the companies forced to take it.
Did they say that? They also say that they wouldn't have been negatively impacted by AIG. I think we have to take all that with a grain of salt. But it doesn't matter, and the fact that they've paid back the TARP money doesn't matter, because this was only a small slice of the government assistance that they got. Much more important than the TARP money was the $28 billion in FDIC backing they got for new debt that they've written in the last year as part of the Temporary Liquidity Guarantee Program, which nobody has ever heard of. And this allowed Goldman almost unlimited access to cheap money, which they then went out on the market and lent at much higher rates. And that's why they made an enormous profit, because their cost of capital was low. When banks get cheap money, they can make money easily, and that's exactly what happened this year.
And this one of the reasons that happened is to qualify for the bailout, Goldman Sachs had to convert from an investment company to a bank holding company, and this is where they received those additional benefits?
When they did that, it made the New York Federal Reserve Bank their primary regulator, and it just so happened at the time that the chairman of the New York Federal Reserve Bank was another former head of Goldman Sachs named Stephen Friedman. You can just see all these connections working in so many different directions.
But does Stephen Friedman, being former Goldman Sachs co-chair and then chair of the New York Fed, New York is silly with former Goldman Sachs managers. Can you point to any direct result of his being both from Goldman Sachs and at the Federal Reserve and now overseeing Goldman Sachs?
No, because one of the reasons we can't point to it is because we have absolutely no idea exactly how much money Goldman Sachs has been borrowing from the Federal Reserve discount window, because there's an obscure provision of the Federal Reserve Act, which makes it impossible for Congress to audit exactly how much money they got from these programs. We know that they've gotten $28 billion in FDIC backing, but what we don't know is how much money they've borrowed, and we don't know how much at what cost they borrowed it from the Federal Reserve in the last year. So it's quite possible that there was an important connection.
Well, what we do know is that at this point, Goldman Sachs has received a lot of money. As you said, they got paid back fully from AIG, and that money was, in essence, taxpayer money. It was bailout money that AIG received and then turned in hand over to Goldman Sachs. They also got the TARP money.
Right.
Oh, and as you said, because they had converted to a bank holding company instead of an investment company, they now were getting cheap money lent to them by the Federal Reserve that they could turn around and loan out at higher interest rates and make money on that. But
and that's the key part. Yeah.
But is that how they made this huge profit? You know, what did they do with all this money they had? What did they invest in?
They went out and sold bonds. I mean, they look. This is how do banks make money? They have to entice people to give them money, and then they invest that money, and they make their profit on the spread. When their cost of capital is cheap, it's easy for them to make money. And so not just Goldman Sachs, but everybody on Wall Street. I mean, the number for Morgan Stanley was $23 billion in federally backed money. It was $40 billion for Bank of America. All of Wall Street had access to ridiculously cheap money in the last year. And we gave them this money. We gave them this opportunity with the implicit understanding that they would kickstart the economy and create jobs. And what we're seeing now with this profit number that Goldman is posting is that instead of creating jobs and kickstarting the economy, they're just keeping it and giving it to themselves in the form of bonuses.
Well, we're also reading that a lot of these profits came from the division that handles the bundled mortgages. Are they still doing the toxic mortgages?
You know, we don't know, but it's one thing that is certain is that because of all this implicit government backing, it's enabled a lot of these investment banks to engage in much, much riskier behavior than they would have normally, because they know that they have this steady stream of profits that's guaranteed at least for another couple of years under these new federal programs.
We're talking to reporter Matt Taibbi, who writes about Goldman Sachs in this month's edition of Rolling Stone magazine. You can link to it at our website, herenow.org. Couple thoughts for you, Matt. You know, if the government doesn't ban the buying and selling of bundled mortgages, and if the government doesn't crack down on selling mortgages, as you write, on the backs of napkins to cocktail waitresses and ex-cons carrying $5 in a Snickers bar, in other words, if there isn't more regulation, isn't what Goldman Sachs doing completely legal?
Legality is kind of a relative term when you have almost an entire generation of non-regulation. I mean, the regulators had plenty of power throughout this time to subjectively look at what was going on, even if it wasn't against the law, and say, you know, these instruments shouldn't have gotten a AAA rating, or this bank is taking on way too much risk and too much leverage, and that shouldn't be allowed. And, you know, these mortgage companies shouldn't be allowed to lend this much to people who aren't worthy. They have the power to step in and make those decisions, and they still have that power. Even though it may technically be legal, it's certainly not proper.
Well, and you say that Goldman Sachs may be averting their gaze from bundled mortgages anyway, and looking at global warming. Now, this is the climate change legislation that's making its way through Congress, and it has a cap-and-trade provision. Many people may be surprised to read in your article and to hear that this proposed pollution credit program is going to be government-mandated, but it's not going to be administered by the government. It's really going to be administered by Wall Street, in effect. Tell us more about how that's going to work.
They could have just done this as a straight tax on carbon. What they did instead is they created this highly complex new commodities market where companies are going to be trading in carbon credits. Now, you know, Goldman Sachs spent about $3.5 million last year lobbying for the passage of this bill, and that's not surprising since, A, they're part owner of the Chicago Climate Exchange, where these credits are going to be traded if the law passes. Also, they're heavily invested in a number of companies that deal with carbon credits, and you know they're also going to be doing index speculation on a lot of this stuff the same way they did with the normal commodities market last year, where we saw the price of gas skyrocketing, and so a lot of people are afraid that there's going to be a speculative bubble in carbon credits the same way there was with oil last year.
Goldman Sachs has dismissed your reporting as a compilation of every conspiracy theory, not just one, but a compilation of all of them. You say that they are a great vampire squid wrapped around the face of humanity, relentlessly jamming their blood funnel into anything that smells like money. Your thoughts about Goldman Sachs are pretty clear. They've been fined on occasion for some of their practices. Is there anything short of changing the way Wall Street works that can be done about it? In other words, if Washington puts carbon credits into the market, well, there you go. Goldman Sachs will buy them. If mortgages are allowed to be bundled and sold instead of held at the bank, then an investment company will buy them and sell them.
That's absolutely true. But whether or not it's legal, whether or not that's the way people make money on Wall Street, it's not right for the rest of us, and we have to fix it.
That's reporter Matt Taibbi. His article about Goldman Sachs appears in Rolling Stone magazine. Again, it'll be at our website, hereandnow.org. Matt, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me on, Robin. Good talking to you again.
And by the way, Matt points out that Al Gore has also started a company with former Goldman Sachs bigwigs to invest in carbon offsets. Okay, just ahead, Elizabeth Warren, head of oversight of the bailout. She says taxpayers aren't getting their money's worth. She's after a break. Here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. If you've just joined us, we were speaking with reporter Matt Taibbi, who concludes that the investment firm Goldman Sachs' jaw-dropping profits announced yesterday were in part because of taxpayer bailout money the company received. Elizabeth Warren is the Harvard Law professor who's head of the panel that's charged with oversight of the bank bailout. Professor Warren, welcome to you.
Thank you.
And first of all, we want to speak about your latest report, and you are doing videos on your reports, and we'll link our listeners to them at our website, hereandnow.org. But first, just your thoughts on Matt Taibbi's thoughts that it was bailout money paid to the insurance giant AIG, which AIG then paid back to Goldman Sachs, that saved Goldman Sachs. They then received TARP money, the toxic asset relief money. And you know, many people are saying, because of that, shouldn't some of yesterday's extraordinary profits, bonuses of $20 billion about to be paid out, be shared with the American taxpayer?
Well, you know, this is the big issue right now. What's happened is nothing has changed in the law. You know, everything that was true basically legally in 2005 is still true today. So all the things that the companies could get out there and do, all the products they could sell, all the ways in which they could make profits and bundle and slice and push risk into the system, by and large, that's all still there for them. So that it's a reminder that we have twin problems that we have to address right now. And one of them is this question about, you know, how we're going to pull the bus out of the ditch. We've got 9.5% unemployment. We've got literally millions of people losing their homes, millions more who are underwater on their mortgages. And the answer on pulling it out has been that we've stabilized some of the big financial institutions, Goldman being the best example. But the second question is, what's the regulatory system going to look like going forward? Are we just going to say, hey, well, you know, we had a little crisis there for a while, and you took $700 billion of taxpayer dollars and $1.2 trillion in Fed guarantees and, you know, more from the FDIC? Or are we actually going to change some regulations here?
Have we put the bus back on the same road toward the same ditch?
Exactly.
Well,
exactly.
You have other concerns as well. The committee you had, the Congressional Oversight Panel, has just released a new report on banks paying back the bailout money. You explain it's not just the bailout money that you're concerned about. There's something called warrants. What are they?
Well, warrants were supposed to be the taxpayers' opportunity to participate in the upside if it turned out that the taxpayers put up all this money and the banks really got profitable again. Warrants just mean that you can buy stock in the company effectively at a low price in the future when the price is higher. And so you buy it, you turn around and sell it, and the profit belongs to the taxpayer. That's the idea behind the warrants. That was supposed to be our payback.
Well, but you found, when you looked into this, that in fact banks are trying to buy those warrants back from the federal government, and in so doing, they're getting a real bargain.
Yeah, so the banks want to take these warrants off the market. They want to say that, listen, let's emerge, let's pay you back your TARP money, and let's retire those warrants. Let's get these warrants out of here. I don't want you coming back in 5 years and making a killing on our stock.
Right, because as you explained in one of your videos, the federal government, for instance, could buy a stock at $5, just
yep,
picking a number out of the air, and then turn around and sell it if it's worth actually $30 and mm-hmm, make some money for the taxpayers. So the banks are kind of looking at this now and saying, let's get those warrants back.
That's right. So the question is, if we're going to sell them back to them, how much should we sell them back for? So this is going to be a big issue going forward. And Treasury has sold about 1%. It's been tiny little banks. They've been banks that are small. But what we did is we went in and we did the numbers. We crunched the numbers on what the bank, on what Treasury had charged for those warrants so far. And what we found so far was that Treasury was charging about 66% of the market price. Now, you know, there may be reasons they need to get out fast, or they may want to do the numbers a little differently. We had some really good experts take a look at this. People from the Harvard Business School went over at least our formulas and kind of what we were putting into the numbers. We think this is really worrisome. So, But here's the key thing.
Because
you may
I just want to jump in and say, because that means that extra 40% or so that they could have gotten, the Treasury didn't get for taxpayers. They're selling them back to the banks at a bargain.
That's right, at a big discount.
Right.
Okay? So here's the thing. You may remember that way back in November when Secretary Paulson put money into the banks, he said, I'm getting stocks and warrants worth 100 cents on the dollar. We did our analysis and said, no, in fact, you're getting stocks and warrants. You're going to love that the number's the same for about 66 cents on the dollar. You're not getting fair market value. It cost the American taxpayer literally about $80 billion just in the first series of transactions. But the problem was back then, it had already happened by the time we could do the analysis. In fact, it had already happened by the time our panel was formed. This time around, we jumped in as soon as they did 1% of the transactions. We've waved a flag and said 99% of the transactions are coming up, and we are here to watch.
And what are you going to recommend going forward that the Treasury do to make it different?
Well, we have recommended that they take a very close look at the valuations that we used, and that they be entirely transparent. Let everybody see what numbers they're using. But we have also suggested, why don't you just think about taking them to the market? That is, let everybody bid on them. Don't just do this, you know, where a bank buys back its own warrants. Let's put them out there for bid. And if the bank wants to bid for its warrants, let it do it. But let it do it in an open market where others are bidding as well. That, we think, reaches the fair market value.
And do you think ultimately, we started by talking about Goldman Sachs' huge profits, is there going, do you see that there is going to be a change so that companies can't get back in risky businesses, they can't blow up the bubbles again?
So here's the really shocking thing. Right now, the best regulatory proposal on the table, in fact, the only one that's really spelled out, is for the Consumer Financial Protection Agency. And the idea behind it is to make the consumer part of the financial product market safer.
And make it more.
What are the banks doing? They are building up their war chest. They're putting it right in the crosshairs, and they're saying they'll do everything they can to stop it.
To stop it. Well, that Consumer Financial Protection Agency was your idea, was Elizabeth Warren's idea, to make things more transparent so we know what mortgages look like, we know what credit card deals look like. Elizabeth Warren, Harvard Law professor, also overseeing the bank bailout. We want to have you back to talk about your Consumer Financial Protection Agency and banks who are mounting an attack on it. Elizabeth, thank you.
Thank you.
Be back after the latest news here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Space is in the ether this month as we mark the 40th anniversary of the first moon landing. In a few minutes, is the U.S. going back? But first, let's check in with Elon Musk, whose goal is beyond the moon to Mars. The South African high-tech entrepreneur made his money on PayPal. He's now chair of the board of Tesla Motors, the electric car company, where he's taken on critics who say his cars are too expensive. And not incidentally, he's also being sued by a former partner in a business dispute. But that's nothing compared to people who early on doubted his other big project, SpaceX, Space Exploration Technologies, which recently silenced some critics when it won a contract from NASA to take cargo to the space station by 2010. And Elon Musk says he hopes to be shepherding astronauts back and forth by 2011. He joins us now. Elon, it's been only 5 years since Congress passed a law allowing private commercial spaceflight. You now join Richard Branson's Virgin Galactic, but they're only focusing on low-orbit space tourism. So what is your ultimate vision for spaceflight?
Mine is quite a bit beyond that. It's not commercial spaceflight simply for commercial sake. The overarching goal of SpaceX is to play a significant role in the extension of life beyond Earth, ultimately to help make life multiplanetary.
I've read that when you think of this idea, what you're speaking of, and the idea of life expanding to other planets, you say it's one of the few key moments in the history of life on Earth.
Yeah, I think if you use the lens of history and say, what are the major milestones in the evolution of life? And of course, there's the advent of single-celled life, multicellular life, the differentiation into plants and animals, creatures going from the oceans to land, mammals, consciousness, you know, there's about half a dozen or so really big ones. And I think on that scale would also fit the extension of life to multiple planets. I mean, it would be, I think, at least as important as life going from the oceans to land, and arguably more important because it's much more difficult.
Well, creatures going from sea to land might have argued that, but we take your point. And wonder, what about critics of private space exploration? You are a very wealthy man. People say your Tesla cars are too expensive. They're rich man's toys. And those same people might worry about very wealthy private individuals taking over space exploration.
Well, I don't think it's any different to any other transportation industry. You know, take the opposite tack. Would you really want the government running all our car companies and our aircraft companies in the long term? Would you prefer to fly on Aeroflot, or would you prefer to fly on Southwest?
I guess the worry is, you know, is it going to be the Branson Moon or the Elon Musk Mars? You know, people who worry that space should belong to everyone, not private enterprise.
Well, I don't think you can have space belong to everyone, just as you cannot have your car or your house or your property here belonging to everyone. I mean, would you advocate that the United States should belong to everyone and that there should not be property rights?
Yeah, but there's something about the moon, and we've been speaking to people, what with the anniversary of the first footfall, about the thinking that there might be international treaties, much like there are international treaties about the oceans, about where you can fish and who owns what discovered gold treasure. There's a thinking that that's the way the moon should be.
You know, I don't have a great interest in the moon because I don't think the moon is suited to create, you know, a second ecology, whereas I think that is possible on Mars, albeit very difficult. As for sort of ownership, I certainly wouldn't assume that I would own Mars or that SpaceX would be the only company taking people to Mars. That would be like saying like the company making the wagons going across the western United States somehow owned the western United States.
Well, you are making the wagons now for the space flight. We know you had a number of failed launches. You know, if at first you don't succeed. Last year, you became the first private company to shoot a liquid-fueled rocket, the Falcon 1, into orbit. Tell us about that success, and what does that mean about how you go forward?
You know, developing rockets is very difficult. If something's easy, it's not rocket science. You know,
right.
Flying rocket science is pretty hard. So,
right.
So you have two things. You have the rocket booster, which is what sort of carries things to orbit, and then you have spacecraft that kind of maneuver around once they're in orbit. We've designed our Dragon spacecraft to carry people as well, and we think we could be carrying astronauts to the space station probably in about 3 years.
That's Elon Musk. He's the South African high-tech entrepreneur who's also the chief technology officer and CEO of the company SpaceX for Space Exploration Technologies based in California. Thank you so much, and best of luck to you.
Thank you.
Welcome back.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Monday, July 20th is the 40th anniversary of Neil Armstrong's Small Step for Man, a footfall that electrified the world. But consider this, 4 out of 5 people on Earth today weren't alive when Armstrong stepped on the moon, and it's been decades since the last manned mission there. The moon is so 1969. 5 years ago, President Bush set a goal to establish a permanent human presence on the moon by 2020, but he never mentioned the project again. And today, with a recession and a $50 billion price tag to get there, the question is, do we really need to go back to the moon? David Mindell is professor of the history of technology at MIT. He's also author of Digital Apollo, Human and Machine in Spaceflight, and he's a contributor to IEEE Spectrum Magazine's recent issue on spaceflight. David, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, David, let's talk about what enthusiasts say are their, let's say, top 5 reasons for going back to the moon. What are the reasons given?
Well, you hear reasons for going back to the moon cover a pretty broad spectrum. They go everywhere from studying the moon scientifically and learning about lunar geology, on one hand, very sort of rational plotting type of goal, to learning how to seed other planets with human colonies and human destiny to escape the Earth, sort of on the more other end of the spectrum. So there's a variety of reasons that people give. One of the traditional ones is great nations send people into space. That's what great nations have to do. And that's certainly why we went to the moon the first time. And if we go back, it will probably be the main reason we go back, because a lot of the other arguments don't justify those huge price tags and those years and years of effort in and of themselves.
Those price tags, as we mentioned, could add up to $50 billion. But what about the idea that you need the moon as a stepping stone or a training ground for human exploration of Mars?
Well, there's a lot of different schools of thoughts on that. The argument goes that in order to go to Mars, it's so far away that you'll never be able to send people there unless they somehow learn to live off the land. That is to say, extract resources from the soil and from the atmosphere that will allow them to live and potentially provide fuel to return and so on. And that you have to go to the moon in order to develop some of those technologies. There's also the argument that we really don't know how people will respond in very long term to moderate forms of gravity. We send people into the space station for about 6 months at a time in microgravity, essentially zero gravity, but we've only ever had people in the 1/6th gravity of the moon for a few days at a time. If they go to Mars, which is a third of the Earth's gravity, we really don't know what kind of impact that will have. The real critical things about going to Mars are basically radiation and bone loss, that is, the effects on the human crews. So the last thing you want to have happen is to send people on a year and a half journey off to Mars, and then when they step out onto the lunar surface, they break their bones because they've lost so much bone on the way.
Huh.
So there's a kind of biomedical argument to go back to the moon as well.
Huh. But what about within the space community? IEEE paints quite a picture of a conference at which Apollo astronauts and engineers talk about their original mission, and everyone is riveted. And then people get up to talk about the current NASA moon mission. Now, it's called Constellation. Detractors call it Apollo on steroids, though, because it does call for new and more powerful rockets, but it doesn't have specific plans to use the moon as a stepping stone to Mars. And so these young engineers in the audience just sort of slump back. Their attitude is described as been there, done that.
Yeah, NASA has not done a good job of explaining why it's important that we go back to the moon to the general public. They have not done a good job of generating excitement over that goal. They haven't done a good job of explaining what they're going to do there that's different from what we did there before. And that's one of the reasons that a lot of people believe we should just try to go directly to Mars and not go to the moon.
Yeah.
There's a real danger that if NASA goes back to the moon, and they're sort of headed down this road now, they'll set up a giant lunar base. It will become like the space station, this incredibly expensive thing that requires maintenance and all kinds of support and ongoing funding for years and years and years, and that will sap all the resources for going to Mars, yeah, much like the space station now is sapping some of the resources to go further out.
Much in the way the space race in the 60s really propelled the U.S. when they were competing with then the Soviet Union, the Chinese have announced a goal to land a human on the moon within the next 20 years. Would that light a fire under some people who aren't right now excited about the moon?
Some people think it would. The U.S. finds itself in an interesting and a sort of difficult position, which is that a lot of Americans don't believe that human spaceflight necessarily represents the strength of the nation in the way that people did in the 60s. But a lot of people in other countries do believe that. And increasingly other powers, particularly India, China, even Japan, have bought into the idea that accomplishments in human spaceflight represent the strength of the nation. That's an idea from the Cold War that the U.S. and the Soviet Union together presented to the world, and now other people in the world have taken that idea on board, and we have to contend with that.
Well, you can imagine that there are going to be Americans who, just the thought of sitting back and watching other countries be on the moon might be difficult for some Americans.
That's true, and I think there are a lot of people at NASA who want nothing more than a vigorous, robust Chinese race to the moon, because that they feel that would be good for NASA.
Mm-hmm. Well, that brings to mind, how do you get young people who have the internet and virtual reality, how do you get that generation interested in the moon when it may feel to many of them like ancient history and their, you know, grandparents' history?
I think the way to get people excited today, particularly younger people who have grown up with the idea of remote and virtual presence as essentially part of their bones, is to allow them to do it remotely. One of the amazing things about remote presence is that it's very democratic. You can spread it out to millions of people at once. So whether you send people or not, you should also send very, very high-resolution cameras, rovers, all kinds of robotic vehicles that will share the experience that people are having with many, many people on the ground. And then each individual person on Earth, each individual kid in elementary school basically can pop a CD into their Xbox or connect it to the internet, and they themselves then become the explorers of these new places. That's the kind of excitement that will get people very excited and involved.
Well, the Obama administration is now in the process of reviewing all the government space programs, looking at technical options available. What would you tell the president? You have his ear, David Mindell. What would you say if he asked, should we go back to the moon?
I would say that whatever we do, we should have a human spaceflight policy that is coherent. Right now, we have a space policy that is not coherent, where the policy is insufficiently clear on what should happen, and so the engineers end up making decisions that will constrain us in the future. So wherever we go, the most important thing is to send people, to be clear about the reasons that we're sending people, to be clear about what about those reasons entails the risk and probably the loss of human life, and to get the public behind that set of ideas.
David Mindell is author of Digital Apollo, Human and Machine in Spaceflight. He's also, as we said, a contributor to IEEE Spectrum magazine's recent issue on the future of spaceflight. For more on that, you can go to our website, hereandnow.org. David, thank you.
Thank you.
The new Harry Potter film, Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince, takes the story into darker territory.
Did you know, sir? Then?
Did I know I just met the most dangerous dark wizard of all time? No.
For Warner Brothers, that territory is also astoundingly lucrative. Potter, made in Britain but US financed, has already taken $4.5 billion in cinemas worldwide. It's the biggest film series or franchise ever, and that's before the sixth film opens this week. With only one Potter novel still left to adapt, the studios are looking around for the next big cash cow. But putting any film into production is an act of faith. Connor Dignam, editor of the magazine Screen International, says a focus on franchises such as the Bourne films or The Lord of the Rings is supposed to limit that gamble.
The franchise movie allows Hollywood executives to recognise that the money they're investing is less of a risk. So every multi-million dollar movie is an enormous risk. Having a franchise attached to, you know, signing off those checks just makes these guys feel an awful lot better about the money they're spending.
Long-running film series aren't new, but they used to be associated mainly with cheaper productions, such as the old Sherlock Holmes films or the British Carry On comedies. Then, a few years ago, the franchise met the blockbuster and Hollywood had its new goldmine. Though, as American journalist Claude Bredesa-Akner explains, not all profits are from the movie as such.
Largely because those movie studios are no longer just movie studios. They're owned by mega monolith corporations that have many, many tentacles, not the least of which is the Consumer Products Division, which is sort of the holy grail of movie making. If you can make a movie that not only succeeds as a franchise, but that it also energizes the company in other ways, in consumer products, in bedsheets, in lunchboxes, and toys, and that sort of thing.
Strangely, Harry Potter fails this all-important test. Its spin-offs sell poorly. The Potter audience has mainly outgrown the dolls and toys, which are the mainstay of movie merchandising. Film critic Simon Rose believes the new emphasis on franchise is changing the way filmmakers try to draw in audiences.
It seems that people are often going to movies, particularly the younger audience, to see these weird franchise characters. That's more important to them, perhaps, than who's directing it, which is probably never very important to young people, or even who's actually in it. The really big Hollywood stars are mostly in their 40s now. The power seems to be in the franchise characters. And frankly, if you're looking at the movies from a more artistic viewpoint, it seems an extremely unhealthy development.
When, a few years ago, it became clear how popular the Potter and Lord of the Rings franchises were becoming, US studios went on a buying spree. Mainly, they bought the rights to British literary works which offered, in the jargon, returnable, family-friendly fare with a fantasy edge. Yet, as movie journalist Claude Bredesa-Akner explains, the creations of Philip Pullman and C.S. Lewis lacked that certain Hogwarts something.
People sought to emulate it. New Line attempted to do so with the His Dark Materials series of books, which produced The Golden Compass, which was an immensely costly film and a big flop for New Line. And that pretty much put an end to the studio as well. I mean, same thing with Disney and Narnia. Walden Media acquired the rights, set up the first film at Disney, was a big hit. They expected big things from the next few films. And in the end, when they looked at the box office projections, it just didn't seem like there was enough there to justify the immense, immense cost that these CGI-heavy kind of films require. No one really wants to place the big, big money bet on these books right now, compared with even 5 or 10 years ago.
In fact, a third Narnia film is now in production, minus Disney. One obvious problem with the C.S. Lewis stories, though apparently not obvious to highly paid Disney executives, is they don't form a unified narrative with more or less fixed characters. That surely is the very thing a movie franchise requires. Simon Rose says, by contrast, Harry Potter offered strong central figures who appealed to young cinema-goers around the world.
It's the fact that they've got some almost proprietorial hold over these characters. I think for a lot of young children, they feel almost as if they're people that they are at school with themselves. That's one reason why it's been so successful. I feel they have grown up with these characters.
At the press conference to launch the new Potter movie last week, I asked one of the producers what the secret is to a long-running film franchise. David Barron admitted that even with 8 years' experience, to him, it remains a mystery.
Something that's core that everyone can resonate with, and you know, the themes that Potter abounds with actually are all things that people, in all walks of life, can resonate with. But we should also remember that this is the first franchise of its kind that actually has this kind of longevity. I, too, would love to find out what's at the heart of it all and find the next one, but they're not that easy to come across.
One of the effects of the growing importance of franchise is that movie stars are finally becoming less crucial to how Hollywood works. Connor Dignam says in many cases the franchise simply is now the star. But he says it's not so radical a change as you might think.
When John Wayne was in westerns, wasn't that a John Wayne franchise? When Fred Astaire was in musicals, that was a Fred Astaire franchise. To some degree, yes, it's a phenomena of marketing and it's a phenomena of international box office. But at the same time, it's about trying to let people know what kind of movie they're going to get as they walk in the door of the cinema.
It seems an immutable law that a film franchise has to be based on a literary work of some sort. It's because what the studios crave is an existing property with a high recognition factor among the desired demographic. Apart from British fiction for the young, the other big source has tended to be US comic strips, from Batman to X-Men. But the next big thing, Hollywood hopes, is the board game. It may sound like a joke, but Sir Ridley Scott is now adapting Monopoly for the screen. And in the pipeline, too, a version of the board game Candyland. That's less of a name internationally, but as Claude Bredessa Ackner says, in America, it's very big if you're very small.
It's probably the most popular board game for children, and it's the first sort of experience that most kids have with a board game. The beauty of that, from a movie's perspective, is that you have positive brand awareness, positive association with that brand, and almost nothing else. There is almost no storyline to a board game like Candyland. It's just little bits and pieces running around the board through, you know, molasses swamps and gingerbread houses and that sort of thing. There's nothing in the way of a narrative to adapt there.
And Claude's term brand may be more revealing than the word franchise, because increasingly Hollywood is trying to exploit the power of brand, just as a clothes store does or a car manufacturer. But they're repeat businesses. The problem with movies is people want something different every time, but not too different. So eventually, even a big movie brand may need a reboot. The 23rd official James Bond movie is due out in 2011, nearly half a century after the first one. 007 has proved the most marketable, the most extendable of all franchises. The film's producers have shown that with clever writing and good performances, an engaging central character can survive almost forever. The same realisation lies behind Guy Ritchie's imminent revival of Sherlock Holmes. And it's why the producers of Harry Potter are moving on to live-action adaptations of that great classic of the 60s and 70s, Paddington, the lovable bear who travels from Peru to London. Doubtless, two more franchises in the making.